All right, hello and welcome to another episode of Colonial Outcast, your friendly neighborhood anti-imperialist podcast, because imperialism, as we hold here, is bad for the global south. It's bad for you and only truly benefits the top 0.1%, which you, sorry, most likely will never be. But hey, keep dreaming. Since the hostilities slash genocide kicked off in early October, I've been trying to rally and platform more military and veteran voices to speak out against U.S. and Israeli policy is both morally reprehensible, murderous, and again, inherently self-destructive. Veterans have an important niche within activism circles because it's harder to dismiss us as radical leftist hippie commie fucks, and it's hard to dismiss guys who have engaged the Taliban, Islamic State, and Al-Qaeda, who we now have a great working relationship with in Yemen, by the way, as terrorist sympathizers. Also, we know that the word terrorist is meant to cudgel the commoners essentially back into line so they don't question foreign policy. I don't know if these two others share my view, but that's definitely my personal opinion about the word. So to discuss as veterans how we came to this political anti-war, anti-interventionalist position, I've got myself, Greg Stoker, a former U.S. Army Ranger. We've got Travis, a show regular at this point and a former field artillery officer, and Josephine Gilbo, a recently separated military intelligence officer. So thank you all for taking 30 minutes out of your day this morning to talk about how you got to this point and, well, how we know that Israel isn't really targeting Hamas. I think that's a good two-point discussion to send to other vets who are still on the fence about this whole thing. So thanks for coming on, y'all.
Glad to be here.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Josephine, we recently got into contact because TRT World, the media platform, picked up your interview outside of a protest in D.C. or in a protest in D.C. where you were
a vigil for Aaron Bushnell.
Oh, okay. It was a vigil for Aaron Bushnell.
Yes.
All right. And you basically hit on some points that I've been saying since late October. Essentially, it was a video taken outside of Aaron Bushnell's funeral. And the points you discussed were, you know, you
targeting. Started
targeting and politicians, because you've been lobbying in D.C. too, in uniform.
Yeah. So if you, yeah, let's like rewind a little bit to back to October. So, you know, I'm a 17-year military veteran. I've worked in the intelligence community, both within the DOD and other agencies, actually. And I came to this conclusion because about 7 years ago, I had an assignment where I was following local news media in the Middle East. And so when October 7th kicked off, and I was seeing all the local news media in the Middle East posting what was happening versus what we were hearing on the ground, I was like, whoa, this is so completely different. Like, it was, sometimes I would see things happening and it kind of was the same, but this was like really different in a sense of what we were hearing and the information coming out of what was happening. So that's when I did my super deep dive into what was actually happening there. I spent weeks reading about the historical context behind how Israel was created, what happened to the Palestinians for 75 years, and then what was actually happening on the ground. And a way that I was able to validate that was using Snapchat's location feature, where you can zoom into public snaps that are posted by anybody in the world. And so there were hundreds of civilians in Gaza posting public snaps of what was actually happening, which still was just completely different than what our media and government officials were telling us on the podium. And so I ended up connecting with a lawyer from northern Gaza who now has been displaced 5 times and is in Rafah dying of hepatitis A. And he and I were able to really get deeper into what has been going on there, what has been happening, who Hamas is, what the Israeli occupation looks like for them. And when he started dying from hepatitis A, I got in my car, put my military uniform on, and drove to Congress, pissed. And I was met with John Fetterman, waving an Israeli flag in my face. And that was the first time in my career, or as a human in America that I was like, whoa, okay, our government is super corrupt. There is something deeper going on here that I have no idea. This is not about national security. This is not about self-defense. There is something going on deeper here, because why is John Fetterman from Pennsylvania, this like union worker guy, super patriotic to Israel? It just didn't make sense. So I dug deeper into that and found out about AIPAC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Money. And so here I am bringing awareness to the truth of what's happening here and the truth of the corruption that exists in the legislative branch and the executive branch.
Absolutely. And when we talk about lobbying, the corruption within our government, lobbying is essentially, you can conceptualize it as legal corruption, legal bribes for political favors. Like there's
If you lobby with money, mm-hmm. because in lobbying, I've met other organizations that are lobbying for like more benefits for people who might be blind, or there were people lobbying for youth homelessness. There's lobbying in a sense of trying to bring awareness to our congressional leaders who may not know about a specific subject or topic, and you want to just bring awareness to that. And then there's lobbying where you sign this very big check and say, I'll keep you in office, I'll support your campaign, but you have to vote in a way that supports what I'm telling you.
Yeah, that's a great call out, because there's a bigger difference between lobbying for an interest or lobbying for an issue and lobbying for a foreign government, right? I mean, it still kind of blows my
mind
that that's even legal.
That's right. And I did some research about that. Why aren't they registered under the FARA Act?
Yeah.
No lawyers have come together to actually take this to court and make a big deal about it. And so they just...
Yeah, well, because
under the radar.
Yeah, because they're. I mean, a lot of people. You hit on it, right? Like, we'll get you elected, or we'll get you elected next time. And the adverse is also true. If you don't take our money, this is APAC's playbook, right? If you don't take our money, we'll get you primaried. We'll work very hard to get you primaried and get you defeated. Yeah. And they seem to be more. Their penetration seems to be even more ubiquitous than most PACs, because you have people like I'm originally from California. You have people like Katie Porter, who ran on, and stumped on, I won't take PAC money, I don't take special interest money. But she did take APAC money, and
it's
like, yeah, if you're going to take one, they're going to take that one. And the penetration across both parties is insane. There's not a lot of special interests like that where you're like, oh, you have 97% of all of our elected officials, or something like that. 95.
I will tell you this, the past 2 days, APAC has been lobbying inside of Congress, and they are being met with Palestinians, with people advocating for Gaza. And it was so bad that one of the guys even asked for security from the Capitol Police because he was being bombarded by people. And that just goes to show you that there are cracks in that empire. There are cracks. And when there's cracks, it'll fall down eventually.
I got an Instagram message from them that said, we're looking for Americans to tell pro-Israel stories. Essentially post pro-Israel stories. And I was like, I think you're barking up the wrong tree, bud. But
I always make it a point to comment underneath their sponsored ads to call them out for being terrorists.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, that's another thing I wanted to talk about, this word of terrorist, this mobilization of it, because, I think like as vets, we kind of have a shield against that kind of, but like what I get mostly in order to discredit me, because I've been very vocal about this and I have a somewhat of a big platform where I do draw some heat, is either I'm accused of stolen valor, which is like their first one, and if you don't know what that is, for all the listeners, that's where you essentially lie about military service, like what you've done, what unit you are in, awards you are given, which is actually a really dumb thing to accuse someone of, because it's so easy to disprove. You literally have a piece of paper, because the military does a lot of paperwork, and you can just show that.
Specifically attacked his unit awards on his uniform, which is hilarious, because half the soldiers in uniform are wearing the wrong unit awards.
That's why I chose to do this podcast in front of this.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So, yeah, they can accuse us of stolen valor or like being a disgrace to our uniform. And at this point, I'm just like, whatever, dude, like you don't really know what was like going on, like overseas in a war like Afghanistan, where it's just like, okay, was this really ever something that was meant to be won? Or was it just an exercise? And like, it's beyond the scope of this conversation.
I agree with you, Greg. I've really found myself questioning a lot of my assignments, a lot of things that I've participated in. I've really found myself questioning what was the truth behind those missions and were those people actually guilty of something? Yeah, it's weighing heavy. And I think a lot of veterans are actually starting to contemplate that, who are being educated on this situation. The biggest hiccup right now with some of these veterans, like what you're saying right now, is they're uneducated and unaware of actually what's happening. And they're taking at face value what the Western media is telling them instead of doing their own digging.
And that disparity is huge. And who's surprised when you find out that you've got, you know, domestic or national news organizations running their copy through their Tel Aviv desk for censor approval from the Israeli government before it gets released in the United States, which is just insane. I mean, show me another country where that happens.
My husband actually made a really good statement about why veterans may be choosing to keep their head in the sand, because he's a 12-year Navy vet. And he said the reality of someone finding out that what they did during their time in the military wasn't for the greater good and actually was for the elite is so heavy that facing that would mean we might have a lot more Aaron Bushnell.
Yeah, Greg and I talked about this like October 8th, literally like around that time we were having these conversations, whereas like, because we were finding the same thing. Some vets would immediately go with new information, realize, oh crap, this is what's actually going on. And a lot of them would be very resistant. And it's because it requires a look in the mirror. The second you start looking into that, now you're looking at yourself in the mirror. Now you're looking at your history. And, you know, for a lot of us, our former identities were very, very tied up in what we did. And so it's a hard look.
It is. And it's heavy. I mean, we do heavy things. So it's heavy to face.
When it comes to serving the interests of the elite, when I started to realize this, when I started going into more intelligence capacity and I started having to get more versed in coin operations, which is, if you don't know, the American counterinsurgency doctrine that we're using in Iraq and Afghanistan. And McChrystal's office put out this slide, coin dynamics and security. Basically all of this, and everybody got this, and everybody had to study this, and everybody was like, what the fuck, over. Just on a very basic surface level, I started to intuitively think like, is this a war meant to be won? Because what the hell is going on here? And not just that, when it came to Afghanistan, like, and I was involved in like kinetic strike targeting. Josephine and I were talking about this before when we first connected. Like, there are people in Gaza, that are apparently connected to Hamas, because, you know, everybody is connected. So like, just because he made like a phone call to a guy who may have been connected to Hamas, well, that guy's eating a Hellfire missile from a drone when he turns on his cell phone in Gaza. And if it was happening in Afghanistan under Obama's insane drone strike policies, which were inherently a war crime, what's happening in the Strip?
And that's and there's a huge difference there too, because the scenario is awesome, right? In Afghanistan, you make that phone call or you receive that phone call and you eat a Hellfire. That's not what's happening there, right? You get mm-hmm. some first or you get some second or third order connection, supposedly. I would argue they're not targeting anything, but I would argue they're targeting population density centers, but and instead of a Hellfire,
destroying infrastructure,
which is a direct fire, point to point munition of limited yield. They're dropping GBU, they're dropping 2,000 pound, GBUs on there, some guided and some not, in a city. And you're talking about when, how we all started switching around how we viewed this. One of the biggest points for me, it started slowly longer ago when I actually went to Israel and was like, this is a propaganda tour that I'm on right now. But the real point was when I started watching them drop 2,000 pound bombs into have dense urban environments. And as an artillery officer, I'm looking at this going, your stated goals were counterinsurgency and hostage rescue. I've never seen anyone do that with the GBU series bombs in an urban environment. That's not how that works. That's insane, you know?
Right. So let me ask you that question. As someone who was an artillery officer, whenever you are assessing if you're going to drop a bomb in a location, what do you assess as far as civilian casualties?
Yeah.
What does that look like in
Greg, the world? Greg made a video on this. Maybe we can link it later, but Greg made a video on this, but going through the entire like NATO checklist, or, you know, the US military's checklist of what is, you know, what is the facility? What is the population density? What are the likely casualties? Are there religious sites? Like there's a whole rule set that says, this is this category of target. And based on the amount of collateral damage for that target, that equates to a clearance level. And the stuff that Israel is dropping in the US military would be a 2-star. You need a division commander to sign off on any of the stuff they're dropping. That's clearly not happening. Or if it is, that's even worse. But
yeah, and it wouldn't be a blanket authorization. It would be like one piece of paper signed per strike, and they've got they're dropping like what they've done like 80,000 strikes that like we wouldn't have cleared.
Oh, it's insane. Another comparative point, right, to us or to our backgrounds is none of that was dropped in Baghdad ever. GBUs were not dropped in apartment blocks and residential centers in Baghdad ever during the entire prosecution of the war. GBUs were dropped.
So this goes back to the question of why are we supporting an ally so unconditionally that doesn't align with our own military strategies and values and moral compass? So how do we continue to support someone that knowingly drops bombs on dozens of children every day? That doesn't make sense to me.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, it makes sense through the lens of imperialism. I think, you know, even dating back to 1947, Travis is currently getting some memos written by the post-World War II Joint Chiefs saying that the creation of the State of Israel will cause regional instability. It'll be a net negative for the United States in that region and globally, because it will diminish our reputation. But aside from that, we also do have CIA reports saying like, hey, Palestine is a small, quote, economically weak, a militarily weak country whose economic potential far outstrips its military capacity. And, you know, we need to establish a base there in order to repel Soviet incursion into West Asia and also to secure American energy security, because it is the outlet for Middle Eastern oil, or at least they thought it would be.
Yeah, that my friend from Gaza actually told me yesterday that border that they built between the north and the south of Gaza, they've now created a road that goes right into where they're building the port. Within 24 hours of Biden announcing that they're building a port, they were able to get all the construction machinery in. They've already started building the port. So to me, it seems like this was just a propaganda scheme the entire time. And most of the people in Gaza do believe that this is going to fall right into being a port for them to extract the resources that exist in the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah, if they build a road like that, you know what? They're going to fence the north side and the south side of that road.
Already is blocked, totally blocked off,
so and now they've built the road into two segments now, into two different security segments where people won't be able to move freely again. Yeah,
right. Not only that, is I was talking to some Navy CBs, and those are guys from the Navy Construction Battalion, if you're not tracking, for the listeners. They can build a temporary port in like no time. It wouldn't take 10 months. So what that says is they're not building a temporary port. They're having to use more intensive construction techniques to build a permanent port.
Yes.
Yeah, the US.
I'm so glad you said that, because I know that the horizontal and vertical engineer units have equipment that it's almost like a barge that like flaps open into, and so you can even like, it's almost like a port ship.
That's what I was saying. They don't actually have to build anything.
They don't even have to build anything.
Yeah. The Navy has amphibs. They can pull in and they just put down and then boom, you got a dock. Yeah.
Also, in conjunction with this port, Israel is just spending $150 million to purchase a port in Larnaca, Cyprus, where the aid is going to go through. It's ostensibly to inspect the aid, but they're building another port on the other side. They're buying a port on the other side of the Gaza Marine Basin. So they'll have this port triangle between Cyprus, Gaza, and Haifa. You know,
I've started seeing local demonstrations in Cyprus against one, the airstrips being used for attacks, and now this expansion. Interesting.
Yeah, because Cyprus, still houses two UK air bases, which is in sortie range, fighter sortie range of Yemen. So in case you're not tracking, fighters are taking off from Cyprus to bomb Yemen. And I actually just did a podcast that's going to be released later today about Cyprus with an international Cypriot relations, international relations specialist from there. But yeah, not only that is the idea of the Eastern Mediterranean oil pipeline, which died in 2001 because it was like politically unfeasible, is now back on the table. You have Ursula von der Leyen from the EU, which Claire Daly calls Frau Genocide, going to Cyprus to do something.
The Hague isn't good enough for you.
Yeah, and the Hague isn't good enough for you. So yeah, it seems like a lot of projects are being envisioned right now. It's not just the East Med pipeline that has been reinvigorated. It's also the Mumbai to Europe through Abu Dhabi and Dubai, new Silk Road that's going to feed through Israel into Europe. That's also tied into all of this. So when it comes to Western imperialism, it's always look for where the money is and the special interests.
Interesting. I want to ask you a question because, you talked about at the outset following like local journalist movements and stuff like that. I think what do you think about the targeting of journalists in Gaza in Palestine?
Well, I think initially, so when I first started watching what was unfolding, they were still in the north, invading in the north. So I've been able to watch them go all the way down Gaza Strip, Khan Yunis, now Rafah. So I think what started happening was their PR couldn't keep up with debunking the algorithm of social media spreading the awareness. And so, of course, they were able to link up with Instagram, Facebook, Meta to try and do some censorship. For example, my name, the hashtag of my name on Instagram goes against community guidelines. I'm like, I haven't even said anything as extreme as that guy. He's calling Israel terrorists. I haven't even said anything like that, but I'm censored.
Yeah, I don't know how I haven't been censored.
But the point is they're targeting journalists because it's making an impact. And in order to try and stop the impact, they're targeting them. But here's the thing. For every one journalist that's died, I've seen like three more take on a press suit and start being a journalist. So,
yeah, it's almost like the logic of force and collective punishment aren't going to work.
No.
Also, in your video that was on TRT World, you talked about, the ISR capabilities, the intelligence surveillance reconnaissance, like what we would call drone footage, the incredibly advanced sensor technology. So when you shoot a Hellfire missile at a car that says press on the top of it, you can see exactly what you're shooting. There's no two ways about it.
There's no excuse in the 2020.
Okay, here's like one of the most interesting things is when we go through intelligence school, we're sort of told that the Israeli intelligence is one of the greatest intelligence communities in the world, and they have all these capabilities, and they're super smart, strategic. And I'm like, well, I'm not seeing that. They're either committing a genocide, which is what it looks like to me and to the rest of the world, or they really are not very good intelligence analysts because they're just dropping bombs everywhere and claiming that it's Hamas. So the targeting aspect of things, people need to realize, and veterans especially need to realize, that coming from someone who is one of the strongest armies in the world to be doing this and to say we didn't know or there were human shields. The human shield concept, I'm going to tell you this. In America, if there is an active shooter inside of an elementary school,
we drop 2,000 pound bomb on it.
Duh. Are we going to drop 2,000 pounds of bombs on the school knowing that the children are inside? Or are we going to do some sort of urban op to take him out?
Yeah.
What are we going to do here?
I saw someone else rephrase that same thing. I saw someone else rephrase that same point as like, what if Hamas was in an Tel Aviv hospital? Would the IDF bomb that hospital?
Exactly.
You know,
I mean, for, in order to not be hypocrites and for consistency's sake, we need to start dropping active shooters in hospitals and schools.
Yes. If there's an active shooter in an elementary school, according to Israeli government's strategies, you must bomb the entire school.
Yep.
That's what this term human shield that they keep referring to means in a sense of an American concept.
Yeah, but also like...
I just want to ask her a question about something she said, Greg, real quick. Yeah. You were talking about like competence level, and we've looked at competence level on the ground, just watching operations and, you know, how units are performing in the field, how, like what the kind of security they're pulling, how close Hamas is getting to them, you know, stuff like that, stuff that we can see and know. I'm curious if you have seen examples of competence level, you know, on their intel side, because I have to assume yeah. if the Army looks this degraded in amateur hour, you know, in these components, I'm curious, is the intel section the same way, you know?
Well, actually, I think that the Israeli forces have an understanding that they lack competence, both in intelligence strategy, in field strategy, which is why they're dropping bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have the ability to actually do urban ops and take out these high-level commanders.
Agreed.
So they just keep dropping bombs. These are reservists that hardly ever do any field training, obviously, and they're doing TikToks. That it blows my mind. They're doing TikToks in the middle of a war. I don't recall ever doing that even during field training.
Right. And also, I keep trying to bring this up, and I bring it up all the time, but in case there are other vets listening, their entire military doctrine is based on collective civilian punishment. In 2006, when the IDF invaded southern Lebanon, they got rolled up real quick by Hezbollah. Okay, so what they did was they carpet bombed the shit out of a suburb in West Beirut called Daya, and because what they wanted to do was hurt the civilians so badly that if Hezbollah ever tried to attack them again, the civilian population in Lebanon would stop them. It's a completely absurd doctrine to have for your military, but it serves the core. It's at the core of Israeli policy on the ground, operational policy. And so basically what they're doing, and the only thing they can do, again, because they are a conscript military whose leaders are, quote, unequipped to fight a real war. That's from a official U.S. Army literature from the 2006 war. They put collective punishment on civilians in order to pressure the combatants to lay down arms. And that is collective punishment, obviously, which is a war crime. Their entire military doctrine is, in effect, a war crime.
Yeah,
well, Greg, let's talk a little bit for a second about the combatants themselves.
Yeah.
And who is Hamas? Because I feel like people keep saying Hamas, Hamas, terrorists, Hamas, terrorists, and mm-hmm. don't actually take a look at the group, of the group, the backing, the background of the group. And I think it's important that as veterans, we touch on who these people actually are and what their goal is so that people don't put them into the same category as, let's say, ISIS.
Yeah, I remember one of my Joes in Baghdad in 07 during the surge talking about a group that had just attacked us and kind of loosely using the phrase terrorists. And I remember telling him, you know, hey, these guys attacked us. We're uniform military target, you know, I didn't say occupying at the time, but I was like in their country.
I say foreign invaders.
Yeah, it was like when you shoot at us, I was explaining, like when you shoot at us, that's not terrorism, that's insurgency. And, you know, we've done it too. So
look, the example I use is I was born and raised in Louisiana. Every single person that I know has a weapon there to use, whether it's to hunt, self-defense. And if someone invades South Louisiana below I-10, I guarantee you that we are going to defend our land from any foreign invader. And then in this situation, we would be labeled a terrorist for protecting our children and our land. And that's sort of what's happening with Hamas here. For 75 years, their people have been targeted over and over. Their children have been targeted. Their economics have been targeted. I mean, in every aspect, they have been dehumanized. There's no freedom of movement. And so what do you think is going to happen when you push people into a corner for generation after generation? You have these teenage boys who watch their parents get killed, their siblings get killed. If that were us here in America, we already know what we're about to do.
I think it's an especially good message for veterans, because it's like you voluntarily picked up a rifle with none of those circumstances.
Yes.
Think about if you had grown up in that environment, whatever militant group was present, that's where you would be. I also want to say, having been to JRTC, I would rather smoke myself than invade Southern Louisiana. But
Fort Pope. <Woo-hoo! laughs>
Yeah. But yeah, like that's a message that I've had conversations with other veterans, and that one resonates, because it's like, hey, okay, you did this, you joined the military anyway, and your parents were fine, and your neighborhood was fine.
Yeah,
imagine you're not joining.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Imagine you have this culture and these families and these people that for 75 years have been getting attacked. What do you think they're going to eventually do? I mean, it's inevitable that they're going to resist.
Absolutely. And it's not just that. Like when the average person uses the term terrorist, it's either because of, you know, Islamophobia generally, because, you know, cartels use objectively terror tactics, but we don't call them terrorists necessarily. But it comes down to tactics. You know, people think like, oh, they're terrorists, they're suicide bombers, they use explosive belts, they use nerve gas. It's like, according to the Israel's Ministry of War, the last suicide bombing by Hamas was in 2008. They've completely rebranded as well. So when it comes to terror, yeah, when it comes to like tactics, yeah.
And especially like thinking about it from like targeting terms or like, you know, U.S. military terms, to me, like what defines terrorism and doesn't is effects. Like, what is the desired effects? Because if you look at like the FBI goes, you're a terrorist if you're a foreign actor and affiliated with a foreign terrorist organization. The FBI says domestically, you're a terrorist if you commit illegal acts in support of an ideology, then the FBI will call you a terrorist. I was just reading their definitions just out of curiosity. But to me, what makes a terrorist or not is effects. What were your desired effects? Were your desired effects, you know, inflicting damage and trauma on the civilian population or civilians? Because if that's the case, then yes, you know, or at least that specific behavior was, you know. But again, if you're attacking military forces or armed forces of any kind, you know, as we saw on October 7th, I mean, a lot of those kibbutzes are armed. Those aren't civilians. When you pick up a rifle, you're not a civilian, you know? And so I think.
I think it's important for us to really look at the criteria of what our government is labeling terrorists. For example, the Houthis, they were blockading the Red Sea, which is a nonviolent way to respond to what's happening in Gaza, which is a genocide. It was a nonviolent way to respond, yet they were called terrorists for doing that. And to me, that was sort of the equivalent of putting sanctions on a country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only gray area there for me, because obviously I'd support a blockade. Obviously, I think that is right. And I'll also add, they declared war on Israel. So if they attack ships, they've already declared war. This is already under a different, completely different context. The only area where they made it a little fuzzy was when they were firing any ship missiles at arguably civilian craft. Seizing, you know, helicopter landing, seizing a civilian craft, enforcing a blockade. These are all activities that I think are very black and white.
That happened. However, as Israel likes to say, they were warned. not
yeah. yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, by their own rules.
Israel gave a 12-story building 2 days ago a one-minute warning to evacuate. The Houthis, for weeks and weeks, have said, do not pass. You're not allowed to pass. If you do pass, we're going to respond appropriately. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you fuck with the money, you get labeled with a terrorist.
Exactly. I think that's what people really need to become aware of. What is a terrorist? How are people getting labeled terrorists? Are we sure that they're meeting the criteria of what a terrorist actually is? Or is it just fucking with the elite's money? And so now they're a terrorist.
Yeah. And we also got to remember, anytime we talk about the Houthis or Yemen in general, we're talking about a people, regardless of what political faction you're speaking about, but you're talking about a people who have been under the same type of tactics that the Israelis are using in Gaza. The Saudis have been using in Yemen for years, and who supplies them? Same yes. ass, same actors.
Yes.
Same result.
Yeah. And people, I guess one thing I keep hearing in the media is like, oh, the Houthis are just using this to like rebrand and, you know, become a regional player and like reshape their image. It's like, and Russia's doing the same thing because they're speaking out against the genocide. And so is China. And that's another point. Like, even for the really cynical, like global security people, it's like, yeah, they are. They're all looking better than we are right now. You see why unconditionally supporting Israel is a bad idea for U.S. national security.
And it's almost
thank
like,
you.
Almost like
there you said it. It is bad for U.S. national security. And that is how you tie back to the congressional leaders, the executive branch, who truly do not care about our national security, because on an international level, we are being viewed as the bully. New alliances are being made. Older alliances are becoming stronger. And so to say that they're doing this for our national security, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
No, it's also making the world in general a whole lot less safe, because every time a global order changes, maybe it's for the best, but like there's some rocky times ahead.
Yeah, we're going into
completely unprecedented waters right now.
Yeah, the memos that we brought up earlier from 47, like literally it's General Marshall telling Truman, if you recognize Israel, it's going to ruin our relationship with everybody else in the region. It's going to lead to the U.S. involvement in stupid, unnecessary wars, and it's going to damage U.S. security. And Marshall went so far as telling Truman, if you do this, I'm not voting for you next time, because you're trading popular votes for U.S. security.
And I
strongly believe that if the Western media would have covered this truthfully, without bias, that the entire American population would be moving even quicker to get our congressional leaders to stop sending aid and weapons, and even maybe do more, like stop them.
Disparity is insane, right? Like even as what, it only took till like November to where you had a majority of the US population supporting ceasefire. You know, it crossed over into a majority, I think, in November, and we're now in March. So
yes,
the behavior of our government versus the population's opinion here is so disparate, it's insane.
Well, every time they come up to the podium and tell us something, Secretary Blinken, John Kirby, President Biden, was saying that the war was going to end by the end of the year last year. Mm-hmm. We're going into March. So everything that they say at the podium isn't coming into fruition. And so you know what that tells me? The Israeli government and Netanyahu are completely rogue. Mm-hmm. There are serious cracks between the relationship of the United States and the Israeli government.
They do not agree
at all on how they're carrying this out. Mm-hmm. Yet we continue to send them weapons, and they're not even listening to us on how to use them and follow international law.
Yeah, you heard that Biden hot mic, where he's like, you know, Netanyahu needs a come to Jesus moment here.
I think he needs more than Jesus at this point.
Awkward phrasing given the people involved, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he needs a come to Jesus moment. Where is it, Joe? Where is it?
You know
how you make him have a come to Jesus moment? Cut him off, and also use your executive power to get APAC to register as a foreign agent. That would be a great start.
Yeah.
So
a ceasefire at this point is the minimum of what the Palestinian people need. People need to be prosecuted for war crimes. People need to be prosecuted for breaking international law. This is not just going to be give me a ceasefire and let's go on about our life. No, this is going to end the way the Holocaust ended, with the Nazi regimes getting prosecuted for war crimes, the Netanyahu's, the cabinet, and hopefully even some of our legislative officials get prosecuted for war crimes.
Yeah, the evidence that we have right now is just what the Palestinians could film and record and transmit with no internet, no power, while getting murdered the entire time. You know, Greg has brought this up before. The UN is terrible at stopping genocides, but it's great at doing, you know, the investigative work after the fact.
I mean, look at the Holocaust. They didn't have any of these things. They didn't have social media, video evidence, or anything. They had witness testimony, and they were able to prosecute these people. And that's how this has to end. A ceasefire is the start. Prosecution is the finish line.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right, y'all. Well, I think it's South By, and I've got a bunch of stuff to do. It's like the big networking opportunity here. It's this massive festival in Austin. But we're kind of out of time here. I wanted to thank you guys so much for coming on and hitting these points about just like basic stuff. But like, we're still trying to bring people on board. And again, as you said, this is going to take a long time. A ceasefire is still a very conservative position on this matter. And, you know, there's going to have to be a whole reconstruction process. There's going to be a whole activism against building this pipeline, cutting Gaza into two, stealing Palestinian oil reserves, which are theirs.
A two-state solution or one-state solution, whatever the solution is going to be.
Once journalists can freely get back into Gaza, they're hosed. Because I truly think that what we know now is like a tiny percentage of the picture that we're going to get after all of this is broken out and investigated. And I'd be amazed if we're already at a majority for ceasefire, I think where the world populations are going to be after like the full truth comes out.
What do you think is going to unfold here in the next like week or two in Rafah?
We've made videos, Travis and I have made videos about this before. An actual ground assault into Rafah is operationally infeasible and quite insane. Not only
do you think they're going to carry it out?
I mean, I think at worst, they will go in, they'll send units into Rafah, shoot a bunch of shit, and then be like, Hamas is defeated. So now we can like
total victory.
I've never seen a situation like this, but it's literally to the point where the literal human density is so high that I don't even know how you move units in and around the area.
In Al-Mawasi, which was supposedly a safe zone.
Yeah, but not even that it's a safe zone.
There, just right on top of the tents. Tanks literally roll on top of the tents, filled with women, children, men, and just roll on top of them.
This has come up before. I keep looking at this going, that's insane, and then not realizing who I'm talking about and that they'll do it anyway. Yeah, because the description we were talking about was like, Rafah right now, you basically take like the Lower East Side or any built up urban area and then take an entire refugee camp and stick it on top of it. And that's your operating environment. You know
that's why a lot of people from Rafah have not left Rafah, even though they've been given this like warning to evacuate, because these supposed safe zones that they were going to evacuate to, they're finding out that tanks are rolling over the tents and killing people. So they're not going to go there. They're just going to take their chances where they are, because they already are so malnutritioned, they don't even have the energy to even be able to walk miles and miles to this new location where they're rolling over people with tanks anyway.
No, and I would never put it past them to do that on purpose. They've done it before. We've seen it before. I just want to add that like from a mechanized unit standpoint, it's hard enough not to run your own guys over during kinetic operations when you're using mechanized forces. It happens occasionally, you know, the US bases, it's happened occasionally every couple of years, someone gets killed by a vehicle. So now take that, multiply it by 1,000, and you're rolling through, you know, a refugee camp with a mech unit. Even if you were trying not to, that would still happen.
Yes. It's horrible, guys. It's horrible.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So ceasefire now. I think we should do another one of these soon. It was great. Hopefully this was helpful to some people. Hopefully you can send it to some of your relatives who you know, still don't know what to think about this.
I do want to say one thing that's important when we start touching on veterans coming to this awareness, that we should maybe try and provide some sort of like outlet for them, like Veterans for Peace, About Face. So maybe like at the end of your video, you can say like, any veterans that come to this awareness, reach out to these organizations. They're filled with people who can help you navigate that.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I'm actually in touch with Veterans for Peace. I will link their social media, their Instagram, and other platforms in the description of this video. So,
yeah, otherwise we're going to go from 22 suicides a day to like 100.
Yeah.
Let's not do that. All right, y'all. Let's circle back soon. And thanks so much for coming on. Hope you all have a great day.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.